May I please report? My name is Kathy Donnelly. I'm here to represent Mrs. Ismay in this case. I intend to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, the fact that this case brings to you matters of first impression regarding the basic principles of the law in medical malpractice cases in 2014 should alert you to the fact that this case is not only about violation of Ms. Ismay's substantial rights, but also an outright access to justice question that is before you today. And I would like to elaborate on that because, as you're well aware, the majority of plaintiffs in medical malpractice cases do not have the luxury of going to appeal or forced bankruptcy. The fact that the unclarity of these issues at the district court level opened the door and has left it for many years for the defendants to influence the juries with irrelevant and overly prejudicial issues regarding plaintiffs' behavior that have no relevance whatsoever to the issues before the court in medical malpractice cases have created the problem that I'm trying to bring to your attention today. And this is your opportunity to address this on the merits in this case. As I explained in detail in the briefs, we are dealing with the first impression issue of the standard applicable principle going back to the causation element in medical malpractice cases when the defendant is trying to assert affirmative defenses of comparative negligence and mitigation. On both of these issues, the Colorado courts have been silent, even though the rest of the nation have specifically addressed that and were unanimous, that the only time that in misdiagnosis cases, and I would like to highlight that issue, that we're only here to address a very specific form of malpractice, and that is misdiagnosis. That in a misdiagnosis case, the only time that the defendant can raise the comparative negligence issue is when they can point out facts that specifically addresses the acts of the plaintiff that could have contributed contemporaneously as the misdiagnosis was happening.
Ms. Donnelly, how do we get to that question, even if we assume that you're correct about that, given the defendant's argument that the jury found that there was no negligence and no causation on the part of the defendants?
Your Honor, I understand the argument, but first of all, there are two cases that are right on point. Chief Judge Davidson has addressed this issue squarely in Paris v. Dance. That was a case that almost identically had the issue of two jury verdict form A and B. And the then Chief Judge, specifically addressed the issue that because the defendant could not prove that the jury did not take into consideration the factual allegations that went to the alleged comparative negligence of the plaintiff, that it could not have been harmless error. That when the jury instructions are wrong, as here, it cannot be harmless error when you cannot tell with certainty whether the jury had actually relied on that. But even above and beyond the points that were made in Paris Dance by the Chief Judge at the time, this case is distinguishable because of two reasons. One, as I have pointed out in the briefs, the judge specifically ordered the jury to take into consideration the issues of causation in determining the liability. And here I will quote from the verdict form as it was being read to the jury, and I'm reading from page 9. And on the transcript of October 4, 2014, if you find that the plaintiff Cheryl Ismay did not have injuries, damages, or losses, or if you find that the defendant Kimberly Hoyt, PhD, was not negligent, and I'm going to highlight it here, or that no negligence of Kimberly Hoyt, PhD, was a cause of any of the plaintiff's claimed injuries, and by allowing the jury to consider her negligence or other people, This case is completely distinguishable from all cases that have been cited by the defendant, because the jury was allowed to consider the acts of both parties in deciding whether Ms. Hoyt was negligent or not. So that determination was not done in isolation and in vacuum. And aside from that, as the Judge Davidson herself, and also in 2003, in the case REC that is also cited by the defendants, points out, one of the other major considerations for the harmless error determination is the amount of time spent on these incorrect theories during the trial. And remember, this case is completely distinguishable from all others because, as I mentioned in the opening, not having a clear standard for the judges in the district court allowed all irrelevant information to come in from day one. So for 10 days, they had the opportunity to influence the jury with all these irrelevant information that had nothing to do with the causation element that could not possibly go to the comparative negligence of Ms. Ismay. And that is what, aside from the fact that jury was specifically allowed to consider both negligences in determining whether Ms. Hoyt was negligent or not, which was not the case in any other cases, because they specifically, the courts have emphasized the fact that if there are two separate analyses, then you can apply harmless error standard. If it is not two separate analyses, as here, and on top of that, you have a trial that has been hijacked by all these irrelevant information for 10 days, then the jury is so overwhelmingly influenced by that information that application of harmless error, again, as the Chief Judge mentions in Dance, is that an error is harmless unless it affects justice or the substantial rights of the parties.
Excuse me, counsel, I don't recall there being an objection at trial to any evidence of comparative negligence coming in. Can you address that, please? You're saying it came in for 10 days and it was irrelevant, but I don't recall there being an objection. You can't have any evidence of comparative negligence made.
Thank you for your question, Judge Terry. Maybe it was not specifically in the terms that I put it, that it is going to the comparative negligence you're not allowed to, but the questions came in very early on. If you remember, one of the other issues that we're having is the objection to the portrayal of Ms. Ismay as an alcoholic.
Right, but I'd like to have you stick to my question.
Yeah, so being an alcoholic was one of those examples, right? That was one of the examples of the facts that came in that was trying to be, that the defendants tried to use that to show that Ms. Ismay is negligent and caused her own injuries. So they tried to portray her as an alcoholic individual who did not act reasonably.
Well, if you want to move to that, I have a couple of questions about that.
Sure.
But I would like to have you go back to my question with regard to, was there any objection that you made at trial that you cannot bring in any evidence that the plaintiff was comparatively negligent? I didn't recall seeing that in the transcript.
I agree with you that it was not in those terms, but what I was trying to explain, and maybe I didn't do that awfully, was the fact that when you're getting to the basic facts that they were trying to keep out, where are the facts that they're going to convert to negligence? Alcohol being one of the major ones.
So, all right, we'll talk about that then. I saw two objections in the entire trial regarding alcohol. That's all I could find, and that's all that apparently you pointed out in the briefing. The first one was an objection to voir dire questioning, not to evidence about alcohol. And that was ruled upon by the trial court judge. And the second was a reference to the word chronic alcoholism. There was no other objection that I could find to saying you can't bring in any evidence of alcohol use. And did I miss something? And if I did, where did you mention that in your briefing?
Your Honor, you did not miss anything regarding that distinction, but I would like to draw this distinction. So there's a distinction between being an alcoholic and using alcohol, right? The reason that it was not brought in those terms is that to give credence to the defense, they could have argued that if there was anything regarding use of alcohol that was hidden from them during the diagnosis period, that could have been information that was relevant. So to go and try to have a blanket rule and saying you cannot talk about alcohol, period, would not have been fair to the defense. And that is why the plaintiff tried to make a distinction between use of alcohol and being an alcoholic. Being an alcoholic is something that is irrelevant to the facts of this case that have nothing to do with causation elements of comparative negligence or mitigation.
But the only objection that I saw about that was to the term chronic alcoholism. I did not see any other objections.
Your Honor, because, well, going back to the record, you might have taken notice of the fact that there was a motion in limine that was filed. Case law specifically says that when you raise an issue in motion in limine, you don't even need to re-raise that issue. However, Ms. Brown specifically re-raised that issue the first time that it was brought up, which is all the trial counsel is obligated to do.
But I did not see a written motion in limine. The only motion in limine I saw was the oral motion in limine to certain questioning in voir dire. Is that what you're referring to?
Your Honor, it was not regarding certain questioning to voir dire, but it was re-raising the issue that if this is something that you're opening the door to, like this is going to be discussed during the trial, then you might have to make a decision whether we're going to address that in voir dire. The motion in limine can be in writing or oral. There's no requirement for the trial attorney, and as you're well aware, most judges do not entertain motions in limine until the day of trial because they want to know what is the context and how it's going to come in, which is exactly what Ms. Brown did. And she was told that it was outside the limit, and that the first time that the issue comes up, she can re-raise it, and that's exactly what she did. The first time that there was a reference to chronic alcoholism of Ms. Ismay, she raised the question to preserve the issue.
Ms. Donnelly, you said you wanted to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you're down to 3:25.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Todd Drake. I have the honor of representing the appellees in this case, Kim Hoyt and Dr. Kent Black. My attorney registration number is 27258. Your Honors, as Judge Todman, as you pointed out, one of the key issues with this case is the entirety, all of the issues that are raised by Ms. Ismay in this case revolve around this issue of her comparative negligence. And that is an issue. First of all these issues are judged under an abuse of discretion standard, the highly stringent standard. But more importantly, it's an issue that the jury never reached. How do we know that? We know that because the jury was specifically instructed, you only consider the negligence of the plaintiff if you have first found that the defendant was negligent and also that the defendant was a cause of the injuries claimed by the plaintiff. That was jury instruction number 26. It's page 3224 of the court record. We know, first of all, there's a presumption that the jury followed that instruction. We also know they followed it because that's, again, the verdict forms, the way they're set up. Had they gotten to comparative negligence, they would have, by definition, had to have used verdict form B. They would have first have to have found Ms. Hoyt was negligent and that her negligence was a cause of the injuries here. We know that that did not occur. This is not an issue that the jury ever reached. It's not an issue that can result in any kind of reversal. At best, it would be harmless error, Your Honors. This issue with the idea that the comparative negligence of Ms. Ismay has to be contemporaneous with the care that's provided. Two things on that. First of all, I submit that actually, I don't believe that specific objection was raised at the trial court level. The only objection to the comparative negligence instructions was that a lack of evidence, insufficient evidence to submit that instruction. And more importantly, ours, there's nothing within Colorado law that instills such a requirement. The statute on comparative negligence, the case law on comparative negligence, the jury instructions on comparative negligence, none of them have a temporal element to them. None of them say patient's conduct must be contemporaneous with the care that they are receiving. And notably, the instruction that relates to comparative negligence for patients, that's 15.6, the pattern instruction, it talks about that a patient is negligent when they do something that, or fail to do something that a reasonably careful patient would do or would not do. under the same or similar circumstances. That is the only context in which the comparative negligence is decided. Here, the context of similar circumstances still revolves around the time frame of when Ms. Ismay was treated and the immediate aftermath. One important factors here, Your Honor, is I suggest that even if there is some contemporaneous element to comparative negligence in Colorado, that was met here. All of the conduct that was related to Ms. Ismay's comparative negligence either occurred at the time of the treatment or occurred within the next 24 to 48 hours. This is not something that it was several years later, it's not even months later. This was within 48 hours, and it all predated the injury that led to this lawsuit, the amputation of her foot. All of that conduct by Ms. Ismay was prior to the amputation, and there was expert evidence within the record, including from Ms. Ismay's own expert, that that conduct caused, or at least contributed, to the loss of her foot. Her expert testified that had she returned, either to the clinic or gone to the emergency room on January 13th or January 14th, she would have been given antibiotics, and it likely would have saved her foot, her lower leg and foot. There never would have been an amputation. That's all that's required for comparative negligence in Colorado.
I'm sorry to take you onto another subject, sure, counsel, but I want to just clarify for myself. Your learned counsel on the other side has indicated that there was a motion in limine. The only one that I was aware of was the oral motion in limine that was made during voir dire with respect to that the issue of alcohol as it related to the plaintiff. Is that the only one there was, or was there also a written motion in limine?
That's the only one that was made by Ms. Ismay. There was a written motion made prior to trial. It was made by the defendants. It argued that the plaintiff's counsel should not be able to make an argument suggesting that because there was some discussion of Ms. Ismay possibly using alcohol or maybe having a history of alcohol abuse, this idea of her being an alcoholic, we moved, the defense moved, to preclude that line of questioning or suggestions that Ms. Ismay was an alcoholic, somehow our witness, we had originally designated an expert witness to talk about alcoholism. That witness was not called, ultimately. We filed that motion, and in response to that motion, Your Honor, and this is at page 2219 of the court record, this is their response to the motion to preclude that argument. Ms. Ismay's counsel argued that such questioning was proper examination, that it had no danger of unfair prejudice, of misleading the jury, or confusing the issues. And now today, for the first time on this appeal, they are now arguing any evidence of alcohol should have been excluded as irrelevant and under 403 because it was unfairly prejudicial and would have led to confusion of the issues. That's the only written motion. And I think, again, the position that was taken in trial by Ms. Ismay, it differs completely from what she argues today. You're absolutely right, Your Honor, the only contemporaneous objection, because actually, at the time the oral motion when it was made with respect to voir dire, the trial court said, your motion's too late. It should have been made 35 days before trial in accordance with the rule. He didn't even reach the substance of any evidence related to alcoholism. He just said, and told Ms. Ismay's counsel at the time, you can make your record by objecting to the specific questions as they are made. I can't rule on this in a vacuum. I will rule on those questions once I hear what the question is and what evidence you want to bring in. The only objection through the entire two-week trial was, as you point out, was to a question a witness was being asked about medical records and a reference to Ms. Ismay's history of alcohol abuse. The original question was going to be include a statement of chronic alcoholism. Plaintiff's counsel, Ms. Ismay's counsel, objected to that. The question was changed to reflect what the record said. It was changed to say a history of alcohol abuse, and the objection was withdrawn. There was no objection at that point. There was no ruling on it. So at no point during this trial was there a question or evidence that came in about alcohol abuse that was objected to. It simply wasn't preserved for appeal.
Was there a separate objection to any evidence of comparative negligence made by the plaintiff at trial?
No, nothing related to the evidence as it came in. In fact, it was often introduced prospectively by Ms. Ismay and her counsel. trying to simply, you know, to reduce the effect, I guess, of that evidence. There was no objection to it when the evidence came in. There was an objection during the jury instruction conference that, again, that there had been insufficient evidence to support the comparative negligence instruction. That was the objection that was made to the jury instruction at trial. Nothing related to contemporaneous negligence, anything like that. So, to your point, no. When that evidence came in, there was no objection related to evidence of her comparative negligence. Very quickly on the alcohol use as well, Judge Terry and all your honors, I think it's important to note this wasn't an issue of saying Ms. Ismay was an alcoholic. That word doesn't appear anywhere in the trial. No one ever called her an alcoholic. The only time it ever came up, if anything, was Ms. Ismay's counsel asked on direct exam of witnesses, do you think she has a problem with alcohol? And the witness said, no, I've never seen her have a problem with alcohol. That was it. The only reason alcohol use was brought into trial, it actually had two bases for that, two relevant points. The first was that it went to Ms. Hoyt's diagnosis of gout. It's undisputed. Ms. Hoyt testified about it. Dr. Black, all the experts testified that alcohol use, increased alcohol use, is a risk factor for gout. It was a big part of the reason why Ms. Hoyt diagnosed gout. She was told when Ms. Ismay came in that first day for her assessment, she asked her about her diet, and she said she'd been eating increased red meat and drinking more alcohol. Those are key risk factors and one of the things that pointed her towards a diagnosis of gout. That makes that evidence about her alcohol use relevant. The second point is the alcohol use after the original treatment, which went to the comparative negligence. Ms. Ismay was specifically instructed, do not drink alcohol. It can lead to additional crystals forming additional gout. It can also have, it's contraindicated with the medications, the Percocet that she'd been prescribed. She was specifically told that. Ms. Ismay testified she understood she was not to drink alcohol after she left the office that night on January 12th. But less than 48 hours later, in her hotel room, she drank alcohol. And again, that question came up through Ms. Ismay's counsel. On direct exam of Ms. Ismay, she said, did you drink? And she said, yes, I did. How much did you drink? Well, I think an ounce. Why did you drink it? I don't know. No reason.
Was there any argument at the trial that her use of alcohol after the incident impaired her judgment about going back to the emergency room?
It did, Your Honor, and that's an excellent point. Her own expert, Dr. McIntyre, who is her one of her psychologists or psychiatrists, testified that she was aware that Ms. Ismay had had a history of drinking alcohol, that she believed that she drank alcohol between January 12th and January 15th, in part based on Ms. Ismay's own testimony. She admitted it, and Dr. McIntyre testified she believed it affected Ms. Ismay's judgment and that it likely masked some of her pain during that time frame. Yeah. And this goes directly to the issue of comparative negligence because the test is what would a reasonable patient do? This mask, her use of alcohol directly affected Ms. Ismay's ability to make reasonable choices. She chose not to go back to the emergency room or to the clinic to go to the emergency room. Her boss, Randall Hope, came by her room twice. Once on January 13th, once on January 14th, looked at her foot, said it doesn't look good. It was getting worse during those days. That's undisputed. Ms. Ismay herself said it got worse during this time frame. She'd been instructed to come back if it got worse. Her boss says, I think you need to go back. Let's take you to a doctor. He offers to take her, and she declines those offers.
Mr. Drake, what you just said is inconsistent with what the plaintiff said in her reply brief that she called the next day and to report that her foot was getting worse, and they said just wait because it takes a while for gout to get better from gout.
Right. I would argue it's not. I don't think it's inconsistent. I think, and Ms. Ismay actually agrees that her boss came by and said the foot's getting worse. We should take you in, and she declined that offer. The issue of her calling into the clinic obviously was a disputed issue. And the only evidence of it came directly from Ms. Ismay. She couldn't recall who she spoke to. She couldn't recall what specifically was said aside from gout get better. Now, the argument seems to go, I read in the brief, was the argument is she can't be comparatively negligent because she followed that advice, followed that medical advice. First of all, we don't know it's medical advice. We don't know who she even spoke to. It's undisputed she didn't speak with either Ms. Hoyt or Dr. Black that day. But regardless, all we're really talking about then is a factual dispute as to whether or not she was comparatively negligent, because there's other, all kinds of other medical advice she didn't follow, and that's an issue for the jury. And ultimately, the jury never even got there in the first place because they decided Ms. Hoyt was appropriate in her care, that she reached a proper diagnosis, that she wasn't negligent, and wasn't the cause of these injuries.
Mr. Drake, as I understand your position, the negligence alleged in this case occurred basically in one visit, the night she saw Ms. White at the urgent care clinic.
That's Ms. allegation, right. Yes.
You never saw her again.
That's right.
But the damages that arose from that alleged negligence, or the causation, occurred over the next few days.
That's exactly right.
And it came to a head when her leg had to be amputated.
That's exactly right.
So sure. During that period of time, her comparative negligence, so to speak, kicked in.
It does. It's certainly, it's back to the jury instruction 15.6. What's required for comparative negligence of a patient is that the patient's conduct joins with the alleged negligence of the defendant.
To cause the injury.
To cause the injury.
Which is actually what your theory would be here.
It is. That's, you know, part
so
of the
So to say the jury did consider comparative negligence may not be exactly accurate. They may have well considered it in their total evaluation of the causation.
I suppose that's hypothetically, is that possible? Sure, but it ignores two things. First of all, they found she wasn't negligent. So they never even reached causation. That's the first question. Actually, the first question is, does she have injuries, damages, or losses? Mm-hmm. But the next question is, was the defendant negligent? The answer, no. They causation never.
And the question of whether the negligence was a cause of injury also answered no?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So they do have some separate questions.
They do have two separate questions. And ultimately, it's kind of a tautology, because the question is, was the defendant negligent? No. Was the negligence, if any, of the defendant a cause? Well, by definition, if there wasn't negligence, there couldn't be cause of the injuries. So I see my time's running out. Your Honor, this was a fair trial. It was well tried. We had an excellent trial judge. It was conscientious, made thorough records, worked through the issues. There is no basis for reversal or nothing that was at the time, that was preserved, the issues that are raised now. There is no basis for reversal, and we ask that you affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Drake.
Your Honor, so I would like to start with your question, one, I think I decided the portion of the jury verdict form that was raised to the jury. That is page 59 of the report transcript. It specifically allowed the jury to consider those negligent within deciding whether Ms. Hoyt was negligent and the causation, and also allows the determination of whether Ms. Fisman was the cause in the totality of the circumstances in order to decide whether Ms. Hoyt was a cause or not. That alone is a problem in this case. Aside from that, the fact that the defendants can spend 15 minutes trying to make the same arguments that they made to the jury, but are all misapplications of the correct law, that the rest of the nation is applying in every single courtroom every day, but that in Colorado somehow we haven't been able to put that in the books so that judges like Judge Brockert, who had done a great job, you see pages of transcript. He knows that there's a problem with this case. He just can't figure out what is the temporal issue. And again, you're dealing with the same part. Ms. Ismay was diagnosed with gout. That was a misdiagnosis. Whatever she was told was based on that misdiagnosis. Whatever that the defendant are claiming now that she did not follow, even if she had followed that was related to the misdiagnosis. That was not a life-threatening disease, gout. Every single case that has been cited in these briefs have made that distinction, that you focus on what was the claim of the plaintiff. The plaintiff is claiming that this woman lost her leg because she was misdiagnosed with gout. You tell someone that you have no problem, it's not a life-threatening disease, just go home, you have gout. The woman is dying of a flesh-eating bacteria. And we are and right now the defendants are arguing to you that because she did not follow the instruction that was given regarding gout, that she's comparatively negligent in her misdiagnosis of
I think it's more than that. It's that she did not go back and did not use good judgment and go back to the emergency room when she saw that she wasn't getting better. She'd been told to come back in 2 days. Her boss said, let's go back, and for some reason she said no.
Well, Your Honor, that's a separate hearsay that we have made the argument that it shouldn't have come in to begin with. What the boss is saying in this case was a triple hearsay, and the defense counsel actually made herself a witness by even bringing that up, because that was a summary of the defense's interview with this person who did not testify in trial, who was not a witness, and that's a different separate issue. But going back to what I wanted to clarify, and I feel like I've missed my opportunity to clarify that here, that we are not talking about misdiagnosis of gout. We are talking about the fact that all the instructions given were based on a non-life-threatening disease. When you tell a woman, you have gout, you have a cold, go come back if it gets worse, do you expect someone to alert, and do you put that obligation on such a patient that you have told you have a non-life-threatening disease, to recognize that, oh my God, if I'm not going back, I'm either going to die or I'm going to lose a limb? And that is why the courts have been consistent in holding that you take into consideration only comparative negligence of the plaintiff if it is contemporaneous.
Excuse me, Ms. Donnelly, your time is up.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your argument. Mr. Drake, thank you for your argument, too. We appreciate both helpful arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.